Today is July 3rd, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover mounting structural strain inside Russia's war economy, fuel shortages, a collapsing casualty exchange ratio, and a steep drop in contract recruitment, alongside a push from OMFIF's David Marsh for Europe to adopt variable geometry, coalitions, and an intensifying U.S.-China contest over who controls the processing of critical minerals. Start with the arithmetic, because the arithmetic is turning against Moscow. According to figures compiled by Kyiv Post correspondents and CIS-linked analysts, Russia's battlefield casualty exchange ratio has reached roughly 8-1 against Ukraine, with cumulative Russian losses estimated at 1.4 million since February 2022. The Odessa Journal reported that Russian assault operations rose 37.5% in May of this year compared to prior months, yet yielded only 14 square kilometers of territorial gain. That's not a rounding error, that's a war of diminishing returns. The strategic calculus here is that Russia is now spending soldiers faster than it can replace them through voluntary means. CNN reported contract soldier recruitment down roughly 20% year-on-year in the first quarter of 2026, and United 24 Media documented monthly contract deployments falling from about 1,700 in April to 1,378 in May. Building on that, per Russian Ministry of Energy data cited by open-source analysts, fuel shortages now touch nearly every federal territory in the country, forcing Moscow to import refined gasoline from India at crude discounts that have widened from $4 to $7 per barrel. A state that projects energy dominance is now buying gasoline back from a country it supplies crude to at a steepening loss. That's a genuine inversion of leverage. More importantly, the binding constraint on this war is shifting away from the front line and toward the skies over Kyiv. Bild's Yulan Robkas reported that Russia's largest single strike package against the capital, 74 missiles and roughly 496 drones, achieved a 91% interception rate, but still produced 56 casualties. The interceptor stockpile, not the trench line, has become the decisive variable. Washington's still unresolved decision on third-party Patriot transfers under the Pearl program will likely determine whether Russian ballistic and hypersonic missiles operate in a contested or largely uncontested environment over Ukrainian cities in the months ahead. The second-order effects are stacking up domestically inside Russia, too. Alpha Bank's chief executive has publicly acknowledged that smaller banks outside the top 20 may face insolvency, following civilian cash withdrawals reported at $5.7 billion in June alone. And there's a lesson here that reaches well beyond this theater. Ukraine's demonstrated 35% drone penetration rate against Russian air defenses, per CSIS citing Jane's Defense, is a live data set on how vulnerable legacy S-300, S-400, and S-500 systems are to mass, low-cost drone swarms. NATO planners elsewhere are almost certainly taking notes. The historical pattern analysts keep returning to is Imperial Russia's collapse in World War I, battlefield incompetence, elite information filtering, and mass casualties feeding into regime instability. This war has now outlasted both the Soviet Union's and Imperial Russia's participation in their respective world wars. The Soviet-Afghan War offers a second precedent. A technologically inferior defender imposing politically unsustainable attrition on a numerically superior occupier. Neither analogy guarantees an outcome, but both point toward the same structural fragility Moscow is currently managing rather than solving. Turn now to Europe, where the question, as David Marsh frames it in his conversation with CSIS, isn't whether Europe survives, it's whether it prospers. He's citing World Bank Group chief economist Indermit Gils, warning that stagnation, left unaddressed, produces instability. Marsh goes as far as calling Vladimir Putin the most consequential European leader since Adolf Hitler, and he traces Germany's fall from G7 outperformer between 2010 and 2016 to bottom performer between 2017 and 2024 to three specific miscalculations: over-reliance on Chinese demand, deep energy dependency on Russia, and underinvestment in the shift away from the combustion engine. Volkswagen's planned reduction of roughly 100,000 jobs is the concrete marker of that miscalculation landing. The strategic calculus here, according to Marsh, is that unanimity across all 27 EU member states is no longer a realistic mechanism for building capability quickly. His prescription is what he calls variable geometry, coalitions of willing states integrating on defense and capital markets without waiting for consensus. The shifting geography of power in Europe right now looks less like a single block and more like overlapping clusters. He points to an 8-state Greenland response coalition: Germany, France, Finland, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, the UK, and Norway, as the working template, with The Hague floated as a pragmatic hub outside formal EU structures. More importantly, a weaker Germany is not necessarily a more resistant Germany. Marsh notes Chancellor Angela Merkel's reversal on collective debt issuance, ultimately agreeing to the EU recovery fund after ruling it out, a reminder that economic weakness can soften sovereign resistance to integration even as it drags on overall European capacity. Meanwhile, the AfD's electoral gains track directly with Chinese competitive pressure on German industrial employment, and the 2024 Draghi report on competitiveness remains stalled by the same unanimity requirement Marsh wants to route around. The historical pattern he draws on is the Werner Plan's original ambiguity: should convergence precede or follow monetary union? An unresolved question, he argues, still sits at the core of the euro's structural weakness. The Schengen Agreement, launched by a Franco-German Benelux core with the UK initially outside it, is his operating precedent for how the capital markets and defense frameworks he's proposing might actually get built. And in a wry aside, he compares Donald Trump's galvanizing effect on European defense solidarity to Gamal Abdel Nasser's 1956 Suez intervention and Stalin's post-war posture, both, inadvertently, catalysts for European integration. Finally, the competition over critical minerals is moving downstream, and that's the important shift to track. Nicole Attidbell of Cupel Advisory, speaking on Kitco Mining's Digging Deep, argues the decisive terrain isn't mine ownership, it's processing. China's dominance spans smelting, separation, and refining, not just extraction. The U.S. Department of Defense's Office of Strategic Capital has issued a conditional $725 million 20-year loan to Energy Fuels to expand the White Mesa Mill in Utah and build a new rare earth alloys facility. China's response was calibrated, not blanket, targeted export controls on MP materials and USA rare earth specifically, restricting their access to Chinese inputs. The strategic calculus here is asymmetry. Bell assesses the $725 million U.S. commitment as correctly targeted but small against China's multi-decade Belt and Road-enabled processing build-out, meaning Washington needs permitting reform to unlock private capital at scale, not just government loans. Guardian Metal Resources' pre-feasibility study for its Pilot Mountain Tungsten project in Nevada illustrates the opportunity. A projected 60% post-tax internal rate of return at spot pricing near $34,000 per ton, with initial capital requirements of $280 to $290 million. Second-order effects are already visible. Chinese dominance of copper smelting has produced a global scramble for copper concentrates, a dynamic likely to repeat across tungsten and rare earths as U.S. processing capacity comes online. Bell also flagged reports of criminal gold from illegal Latin American mining reaching U.S. mint stocks, a regional governance failure becoming a domestic integrity problem. And the politics compounded. Peru's Keiko Fujimori and Colombia's Abelardo de la Espriella both secured presidential runoffs by margins under 1%, while outgoing Colombian President Gustavo Petro's administration closed an area the size of Sweden, the entire Colombian Amazon biome, to oil and mining just before leaving office. The historical pattern Bell invokes is the 1973 OPEC oil embargo, resource leverage deployed without firing a shot, alongside Cold War strategic stockpile programs as the last era of sustained U.S. government investment in minerals processing. The tungsten narrative she describes, capital rushing in on a story and correcting hard afterward, mirrors the well-documented lithium cycle of 2017 through 2023. The one signal worth watching over the next 48 hours is Washington's Pearl program decision on third-party Patriot interceptor transfers. If that approval moves, it directly changes the interception math over Kyiv and signals how far the U.S. is willing to go on air defense before any broader ceasefire framework takes shape. If it stalls, watch for further high-casualty strike packages designed to test exactly that hesitation. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.